Hey guys, welcome to View from the Cheap Seats. We have the Sklar Brothers, and you have entered our podcast. This, of course, you know these things. Jason and I are not happy. If you can visually see this, we are wearing t-shirts that are roughly in the light plum color version, and I'm telling you, we're not happy about it. We should have changed. One of us should have changed, and I'm really upset. But here's what I am excited about: our guest today, as we are on the precipice, or right in the middle, as this drops, of the Ryder Cup. To me and to you, Jay, probably the most exciting golf event of the year, because it's golf is a very individual sport, and this is the ultimate of team sports. You know, Europe, which calls itself the underdog, has won 12 out of the last 17 Ryder Cups. It happens every other
10 of the last 12.
10 of the last 12. It happens every other year. So this is very exciting. And we're going to bring on and talk to one of the greatest golf journalists, certainly in the last 25 years, Robert Lucetic. He wrote an amazing book on Tiger Woods called Unplayable in 2009. And he's been there for all the great moments, like dating back to like the mid 90s. He was there talking to the greats and there in the moments when the great golf moments happen. So to have him put into context and who he thinks is going to win, plus great quick hits, talk about the Angels with him. We'll talk about why
Mike Piazza
gets a drop. And then for our Patreon fans, we talk about one of the greatest two things that two fans do at a baseball game ever. And we'll get into that for our Patreon fans only. But first, let's keep in the world of baseball and let's talk about, as we end sort of the regular season, where it's coming down to the wire, where we're figuring out who's going to be the wild card teams. And I'm looking at the National League and I'm looking at the Dodgers, and we don't know if it's going to be the Dodgers or the Giants that are going to be the wild card team, but they are far and away the two best teams in the National League, probably along with the Rays, the best team, you know, the two best teams in Major League Baseball. But I ask you this question, Jay: if the Dodgers don't win it all this year, because it really is all or nothing for them, if they do not win it all this year, are we going to look back at this 5-6 year run that the Dodgers have had where they were in the World Series, and who knows if they'll make it this year? If they do, it'll be, I believe, the fourth time in 5 years that they were in the World Series. If they don't win it, they've only won one and they won it in the shortened weird year. Are we going to look back at this as sort of the dynasty that never was and sort of the biggest waste of this talent and all this dominance?
So on the surface, Ran, I think you could look at it that way. But if you consider the fact that it is very clear now that the Houston Astros in 2017 were cheating, mm-hmm. that it could very possibly be the same case with the Red Sox in 2019, I believe.
18.
That they were also perhaps sign stealing to a higher level than is normal within the game of baseball, that the Dodgers were
victim of both of those things,
victims of perhaps unfair play. Certainly let's take the Houston series as take the Red Sox out, because they kind of dominated in a way that didn't even make it close. But when you think about that Houston Dodgers World Series, that went to 7 games. That was very clearly decided by guys jumping pitches on Yu Darvish. Mm-hmm. Very clearly they knew what was coming, and they shelled a dude who hadn't been shelled like that all year long. Right. And it appeared in many ways like they were a step ahead, and the advantage that they took from sending messages to Apple Watches and doing whatever the hell they were doing, it felt like they giving them a system of knowing what pitch was coming before it was coming. I think the fact that the Dodgers went 7 games in that series and almost won it, and now it's revealed the other thing, I don't think people will necessarily be as disappointed in them. They won't be seen as like the greatest team that never was.
You'll then have the discussion that they didn't win as many times as they should have, but these things
they could have.
But these things happen.
So I think it just won't be an open, like, there won't be an open chastisement of the organization as a whole for failing to live up to expectations. But I do believe, though, there is a lot of pressure on this team. And I do believe that the pressure to win is now, specifically with how they've built their team. I do think this is not like necessarily a team of the future for many, many, many years to come. I think they can't, they, they're, definitely, they have a lot of promise.
A lot of young pieces and a lot of small pieces.
They have some young pieces and they will be good for a while, but they are definitely built to win right now.
Yeah.
The pickup of Max Scherzer is like, we want to win this
year.
That's
right.
That to me was the piece that they pulled in that they're like, this, we want to do this.
How annoying is it that the Giants are made no moves essentially, and just they're like, we're playing with a bunch of really good mid-level guys in Buster Posey, and we are literally going step for step with this team that has been engineered in, which is with the Yankees West, so to speak.
So as we all know, regular season is very different than postseason.
Of course.
So you got to look at those teams and say, who is built for victories and who is built for a good postseason? I mean, you could look at the baseball Cardinals right now, who kind of had a very mediocre year up until the last 2 weeks. Yeah.
They're on an unbeaten, they won 12 in a row as of recording this thing.
12 or 11?
11. Something 11 in a row.
11. Either way, they are peaking perhaps at the right time. They are firing on all cylinders at the right time. They're coming in through the wild card. If they can win the wild
card, they're getting hot at the right time. And really, it's like, again, look at the 2006 Cardinals that I think they won 86 games, which is really not a lot when you think of the Giants and the Dodgers will win well over 100 games this year. But the Cardinals have won 86. They limped into, I mean, lost a lot of games leading in, and then they got hot in the playoffs. It just matters when you get hot. I mean, maybe, who knows? Maybe the Cardinals are getting hot too soon here. You know what I mean?
Well, we don't know, but I definitely do think there is pressure on the Dodgers to repeat. I definitely think their attitude is, we've got to win now. And I think that's a tall order with who they're up against in the National League. I think Milwaukee's good, and I think the Giants are good. And then on the other side of the thing, the Rays are
amazing. Once again, and I actually think the White Sox with their pitching sort of line up, because we all know that, yes, hitting is freewheeling in the regular season, but defense and pitching really wins you.
Everything tightens up in the playoffs.
So I think there's a lot of pressure on the Dodgers. And if you don't win at all, because every team is going in with the attitude of, we just want to do well, and hopefully we can win it all if we get on a run. The Dodgers are not coming in with that attitude. The Dodgers are coming in going like, if we don't lose, this season is a failure. And to me, maybe that's not the right attitude to go into these playoffs. And that's maybe adds extra pressure that might cause a less than stellar pitching performance, a mistake in the field, a mistake at the plate, a base running mistake. If you're pressing too hard, that's what's going to happen. So I worry about it. But if they do win, it would be one of the greatest meeting of expectations ever. And I think it would change the narrative about the way we talk about the Dodgers if they do win. Anyway, we'll see. I'm very excited. We'll get into more baseball talk as it nears, and as the playoff nears, we'll have more baseball people on. But on the other side of this break, we're going to talk Ryder Cup. We're going to talk Tiger Woods. The great Robert Lucidich is with us. And then later on the show, Doug Buffone from The Great Beyond. This is View from the Cheap Seats.
Hey guys, welcome back to the show. It is a joy to have this gentleman on at this specific moment as we head into what I consider to be the most exciting tournament of the golf calendar every 2 years, is it, I believe? Every 2 years. His name is Robert Lucidich. We had him on the Jim Rome show. He knows his golf.
Wrote an amazing book about Tiger Woods and made a comment to us when we were guest hosting Jim Rome that I want to expand upon more. But Robert, thank you for joining us on the show. How are you?
Well, I'm great. And if I had an agent, he'd be telling me, get on with the Sklar brothers. You'll be big in Slovakia.
Maybe. Sklar.
You got to be big in Slovakia.
We sure do. That name is very Slovakian. I think it means glass blower. We've blown something here.
You've learned something.
You made a comment that I thought was really amazing as we kind of talked about the parity that exists in golf today, that you said it was not, I don't know if it was more fun, but it was more interesting to you when it was Tiger versus the field, like it was from 97 to 2008, approximately. I want to expand upon that a little bit more. What was more interesting and more exciting? Obviously you're watching a guy playing historically well, but what for you was, if you knew the outcome or what it was maybe going to be, does that make it more exciting? You're just watching to see how he gets there.
Well, I mean, look, I remember in 2000 at the match play, Tiger actually lost that to Darren Clark, believe it or not. But one of the few things he lost in 2000. But I remember asking him like, how much better are you going to be? And he said, you always ask me that. And I said, that's because I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I just keep thinking at some point, everyone's going to catch up to you. You just can't stay ahead of the game as much as you are. And for me, there was just, you know, I mean, people say, you know, once in a generation. That guy was once in a century.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so heads and shoulders above everyone else. I mean, Jerry Kelly one time said to me, he had a great line. He said, we were a room full of V8s just revving our motors and, you know, and out comes a V12 and just blows our doors off.
So that's right.
And to me, that's, look, no offense to the great players of today or even the great players that came
before him,
Tiger, but he changed the game and he elevated it and he transcended it in a way in which hasn't been done, maybe by Michael Jordan.
Right.
He was closer to Michael Jordan than he was to, you know, Jack Nicklaus.
Yeah, that's a great. So that's what I wanted to boil it down to, that, because you look at people who transcend their sports, and I think Tom Brady is another one who really transcends the sport in a way that you're like, he may be the greatest athlete. You know, you're saying what, or he might be Tom Brady might be the greatest champion. You know, and you put him up there against, you know, with a Tiger Woods. So does that make the sort of the fall from grace? I don't, it isn't even a fall from grace, but the comeback down to earth so much more tragic? Or how do we put that in context? Because,
well,
yeah,
I look, it's Shakespearean, isn't it?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. He had everything. He had, you know, the world. I mean, I did the documentary, the HBO documentary.
Yeah.
That Alex Gibney did, and which I thought was very good.
Amazing. But,
you know, I had a line in that where I said, you know, Tiger conquered the world. And the problem when you conquer the world is that the world is going to want to get its revenge.
Yeah, that's right.
And it did. It did, because in the end, Tiger thought he became very human in the strangest way. It wasn't losing golf tournaments or losing leads or choking. He became human by falling victim. Although he wasn't a victim,
right.
But still, he succumbed to, you know, carnal pleasures.
Yeah.
He succumbed to being human and weaknesses, and a lot of people would say. And he also, in the end, thought himself to be bulletproof. So all of this conspired. I mean, it was a perfect story,
yeah.
The whole Tiger Woods story. And that's why I really wanted to write the book. I mean, I just thought this guy... What we know of this guy is he's a cardboard cutout with a big smile, and you know he's got the perfect, beautiful wife and the dog and the kids, and he's the greatest ever, and he's, you know, selling Buicks. And I don't know if anybody ever bought one, but
right.
I don't know how many he sold,
right.
But he sold Buicks.
Sure.
But what was behind it? I mean, it just to me was, I just thought there's no way this guy is this thin, this shallow as a character. But as it turns out, you know, his agents and the people around him and Tiger himself were very happy to create this image.
Right.
Because it was good for business,
right.
Good for the brand. And but it wasn't real. And again, I didn't write that book to try and, you know, write some tabloid tell-all.
No.
I just
no.
wanted to say, here's a guy that I've spent a bit of time around. I was pretty close to his caddy, Steve Williams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just a far more interesting guy than – anybody he wants anybody
than what he's showing than what he's showing.
Well, and that would, the more you become human, the more you become vulnerable and the less sort of like this machine you are, which in many cases like almost led to his competitive edge, but it also led to his downfall. When you think about the fact that he wasn't like out there exposing it, Randy and I always said about Tiger Woods, he needed a gap year. He grew up in the public eye. He was – everything started getting on his shoulders when he was 14, 15, 16. He's the next big thing. He will be the biggest thing in the world. And then all of a sudden, he is that thing. And there was no time in between.
For him to like take a year and travel the world and make mistakes in like Thailand. Or – you know what I mean? Like just kind of be
– He would have made some mistakes in
Thailand. We all, Robert, we all would have made mistakes.
To be sure. But – I do think, you know, the story of mental health has now kind of shifted in the most recent times with a Naomi Osaka, with, you know, even a Kevin Love in the NBA, but people talking about your mental health being a part of it. And I think, you know, Earl Woods made Tiger so tough mentally on the course, but in doing so, took away his ability to sort of handle life when it came at him, and it came at him really hard. And so it's like, you think Earl Woods like tried to prepare him for everything and he couldn't prepare him for the downfall. And I don't think Tiger has come out of it. I just don't think he has.
I think the irony of what Earl did was that he actually exacerbated the downfall by creating a robotic kind of a character. Tiger is, I knew this early on when dealing with him. I mean, the guy, there's a lot of arrested development there with Tiger.
Right.
He is, you know, I always feel like each of us has an innate age that we kind of are, no matter, you know, some people are old souls, some people are old bodies, but young souls.
Right.
Tiger was always pretty much a high school freshman.
That's it.
He's, you know, he just has that very sophomoric sort of, bawdy sense of humor. Mm-hmm. He likes to tell dick jokes.
Yeah,
he likes
yeah.
to, and you know, and I always found that, you know, a little, you know, whatever, maybe it was a little silly, but there was nothing wrong with
no.
him. I mean, but he very much tried to bury all of the, you know, all of his sort of potty humor jokes and, you know, locker room. But he tried to keep that just to the people who knew
right.
him. And because he didn't want to spoil the brand of Tiger Woods, and he thought that would spoil it. Whereas my view, and even many, you know, while I was writing the book, that was a lot of what I thought was, people are actually going to think that, you know, I'm revealing things about him, but I think I'm making him more likable just by saying he is a regular kind of a guy. You know what I mean? He has a lot of sort of this normal person that lives inside, but is also very much, you know, he was definitely paranoid. He definitely had the idea that people were always trying to make something from him, their association with
right.
him, their, and that, and listen, he was 100% right.
They're probably, yeah, they probably, I mean, were.
There was a lot of people who did
of
that.
Course. And like, you know, it, to me, in that HBO documentary, and then we'll move on and talk about the Ryder Cup and just golf today. But like the video of him as a high school kid going to the prom with his friends, and it's kind of the period of which you say, like, was, I feel like that was, other than winning a tournament and having the adulation from the fans and sinking that final putt, because he didn't look like he was having fun at all unless he was like hitting a good shot. But that was the last pure joy I saw that. And you could probably say it's probably the last pure unadulterated joy he had in his life was that girlfriend and hanging out with her, and that letter his mom made him write to her, which was not in his language, was like, basically, in my opinion, burying that personality forever.
And that is where he, you know, the Tiger Woods, the person, the kid, is a bit of a dork, a bit of a geek, you know.
Yeah.
Remember, nobody played golf that was cool back then.
No, no.
So he made golf cool, but he really wasn't that cool. And he was a bit of a dorky kid. I mean, you know, his great buddy, Nota Begay, gave him the name Urkel when he got to Stanford, because he had the Coke bottle glasses and he was kind of a dork, you know. And again, you know, a lot of the times when you look at, you know, his secret life in Vegas, a lot of the women involved were really surprised at sort of how kind of immature him and his group were. They weren't really like the cool guys,
right.
You know, they weren't swaggering. They were just more, you know, guys that might have been in the robotics class.
Right. They're like tech guys.
And now
they're
guys. They're famous.
Yeah, they're like.
And now they're like, yeah, they're like but Silicon now, but, Valley guys.
But so then you imagine that personality thrown into a situation where, if you think about Arrested Development at 14, 15, and then now all these women are throwing themselves at you, or there's all those opportunities out in the world. Well, naturally, you know, some people say, well, his biggest mistake was just, you know, engaging with all these women. Randy and I always said his biggest mistake was maybe getting married. Like, you think about Derek Jeter and how he sort of set up his life.
Yeah. Jeter's the perfect example. Jeter was, I would say was doing at least what Tiger was doing.
At least.
But look, he was a single guy, yeah. You know, and here, there's another element to it, which is a media element that, you know, in New York, Jeter was beloved.
Yeah.
Okay. So is the Post or the Daily News going to go after him about what he's doing at 4 o'clock in the morning?
No.
And who he's with?
No.
No. It's bad. It's a bad move because the people of New York, the Yankee fans,
love him.
Rally around.
That's
him.
Right.
And a little bit with Tiger was that he was so controlling with what the media that he did is that, you know, look, you know, did ESPN really want to do tell-alls when he's calling them? He's calling the radio mm-hmm. shows. He likes being on SportsCenter. No, it's a cozy little thing. There isn't going to be a lot of revelation. Is the Golf Channel going to do it?
No, absolutely not.
Not a chance.
No.
So you're down to, that's why it ended up being in the National Enquirer.
And it
broke the story.
It's crazy. So we're looking at golf today and you look at, you know, a Bryson DeChambeau. I don't think I've ever seen a golfer get booed like that or have the reaction from the gallery. Usually if a gallery doesn't like you, it's just going to be silent. Like the best feeling for a golfer is to walk up on a hole and there's the gallery surrounding the green and they're cheering like crazy and giving you that, like there's that feeling. I'm sure the people who don't get that are just, that probably hurts too in a different way, but to hear some boos and to hear some people kind of give him some vocal guff, it to me is, I think it's new to golf. I don't know if that's ever happened.
Yeah, it's not, you know, but he's also tried to change the narrative of golf, right? So there's this sort of WWE vibe that's going on now with him getting huge.
Yeah.
And swinging, you know, swinging for the fence.
Long drive competitions, participating in that.
And Brooks is a, you know, Brooks Koepka is a jock, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I categorize characterize their relationship as, you know, kind of the nerdy high school kid who annoys the jocks, mm-hmm. but he gets in the gym and he gets big and he's got some talent. But the jocks are still never going to like him.
Right.
He doesn't quite get it because he's a bit socially awkward.
Yeah.
So they're the dynamic between DeChambeau. And by the way, he's not the only one. Patrick Reed doesn't get a lot of people cheering.
Patrick Reed, his family doesn't like him. I mean, ask his teammates on his college team and ask his family. I mean, he's estranged from his age. You got to look at that and say, like, is this guy a good teammate? I mean, none of them are. You look at a jacked up DeChambeau and then you look at a guy like Jordan Spieth and you're like, okay, that's where golf was. And I guess where it's going. And I don't know what's better, you know, because Jordan Spieth is an easy guy to root for. He's just an easy guy to root for, and you feel like he represents.
He could play a little faster, I'll say that.
Okay.
He could pick up the pace a little bit, okay?
Fair.
Pick up the pace a little bit, because it's like, you know, unfortunately, the U.S., on the U.S. side now, you know, we have some turtles who are playing golf.
Yeah.
DeChambeau is one of them.
Yeah.
And Cantlay is one of them, too. I mean, these guys could definitely speed it up.
The Cantlay DeChambeau playoff and, you know, the amount that was
is it still going?
It's still happening.
Yeah, it's still going on.
I think John Isner is now into that for some reason, not to bring a tennis thing into that. But yeah, I mean,
we're in the fifth season.
Yeah, but the idea that to me was one of the greatest golf playoffs I've ever seen. Usually a playoff, you see like two or three holes and it's over. But the shots that were made, the points at which it looked like it was lost for DeChambeau when he hit it in the water and then he hits that unbelievable other shot, but Cantlay's just calm demeanor and he works slow. You're absolutely right. But his calm demeanor and the putts he had to make just to keep him around, it shows you so much of golf is you want to hit the ball through the trees and under that branch and over there, and you've got the club in your hand, but maybe the play is to hit it 20 yards behind you to give yourself a better shot. It just like there was strategy in Cantlay. It just showed me that strategy sometimes can beat brute force in golf. A lot of times
absolutely.
It can.
Absolutely. I mean, Xander Schauffele winning the gold in Tokyo, hitting a horrendous drive.
Yeah.
And then just deciding not to even try to hit the green. And
just he to lay up. To
about 70 yards or so. And he got up and down. And he won the gold medal. I mean, to me, that's, that is some cojones.
Yeah.
Because the play is to go for it, and if you screw up, you screw up. But it takes a lot of discipline, and it also just, you got to take your ego out of it.
Yeah.
To say, I'm just going to chip out, and I'm going to try and get up and down from 80 yards. And, you know, when you got your name on your bag and you're ranked in the top 10 in the world, you should probably get up and down from 80 yards, but
it's not as easy as it looks.
It's the gold medal. Literally trying to get up and down for a gold medal at the Olympics. And that is a lot of pressure. So, you know, look, going back to the Tiger thing, there's a lot of great players right now. And I don't like to get into this thing where I'm diminishing that, because I really am not. I think that there right now there's just a really bright future for golf.
Agreed.
It's just a different future.
Right.
It's not the future, because we spent, and I'm guilty of doing this, we spent a lot of time saying, this is the next Tiger.
Right.
This is the next Tiger. You know, they're never going to be.
It's not going to be.
It's not happening in my lifetime.
No.
It's not going to happen. That guy was just so far above everybody. We're not going to get there. And Rory's not that guy. And, you know, Rory's more like the next Phil. You know, when he's hot, he's unbelievable. And then he'll mail in a few. He'll miss cuts.
I mean, the Phil winning the major against Brooks was unbelievable. And to have that guy win that major at that time, when the galleries were finally back, and there was just that mob scene where Koepka
coming up 18,
where Koepka apparently got, I guess, Jeff Galuli took a lead pipe to his knee from Tanya Harding or something like that. I mean, it was that BS, but like, just that whole scene for golf to me was one of those just moments. To me, it was like, it was a moment like Jack Nicklaus winning the Masters when he was 46.
But he was 46. I mean, this guy was 52. Yeah, that's such a huge, that says a lot about where we've come. And Randy and I said, when that moment happened, we said to ourselves, Tiger's going to try.
Yep.
He's definitely not done. Like, he's definitely going to try to come back. Whether he will or not, no idea. But you know him better than anyone else.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that the longer he's away, the more chance there is. Or you know, the more likely it is that he thinks to himself, you know, maybe I can do this. Because in all honesty, I mean, I personally have long believed that he doesn't feel he has anything left to prove. Like, I think Tiger, it was a manifestation of IMG and Nike and Gatorade and all the sponsors to keep this hunt for Jack, the race for you know, Jack's majors record alive, because you keep that narrative alive.
Sure.
And then you can sell more sneakers and sell more golf
and hats and all that stuff. Yeah.
And hats. And,
yep.
And all of that's true. But I think I remember one time asking Tiger, you know, if it all ends, if you don't play again, and this was before he won the 2019 Masters, you know, do you think that will you have felt that you've underachieved? And he said no.
That's it. That's so interesting, because there's the famous interview where he's like, what number means more to you? And of course it was Jack Nicklaus's 18.
Sure, when he was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, Jack actually said long ago, in fact, he said it in 1996, mm-hmm. and I was there when he said it, you know, he said, I think I played with this young man today that's going to win more green jackets than Arnold and I combined.
Wow.
Okay, so that's 10. Mm-hmm. So you have to win 11. And he and Arnold played with Tiger, and Tiger was still an amateur.
Yeah.
And somebody said, so next year Tiger comes back, and he obviously
97.
Does what he does and change the game altogether.
Yep.
But Jack has always said the same thing about whether Tiger would eclipse his record, which is, does he want to?
Mm.
What is he always going to be the person who's focus, singular focus, because it has to be a singular.
It has to be.
Is only going to be on golf. Because as soon as you're interested in anything else, or you have a family like Jack, had a bunch of kids, you know, Johnny Miller, a bunch of kids, you end up with things, you know, suddenly you want to go to basketball practice.
Right.
You want to see your daughter, you know, dance recital. It's, you know, I mean,
your focus gets taken away.
I get it. You're like, same. You don't want to miss out on things.
We say it all.
So you wouldn't go and do these.
We say it all the time. I mean, having kids is a wonderful thing and it's a great source of comedy material for us, but it definitely has kept us from performing more than we would normally do. If we, our friends who are single, our friends who are out there, they're out every night on stage. And we're like, we would have been so much better if that was the case, but we either have to not care about our families or not have a family.
Yeah.
And so you,
and so that's where Tiger was at. And Tiger was literally, I think, at that intersection. And what changed him was the death of Earth.
Yeah.
Because I think that the fact that they had been, I don't want to say estranged, but they weren't as close in later at the, in the last years as they had been. I think Tiger had taken more control of his life himself.
Yep.
Earl was just kind of a grandfatherly guy to go to for some advice. Right. And I think a lot of it, and a lot of the times Tiger just kind of ignored him.
Yeah.
Or just didn't give him the
power, the power he had. The
power and strength that he had
earlier.
That's
right.
But I think that, you know, like all of us, we're in ways big and small, our father's son.
Yeah.
And amen. And when his father passes, it had a profound impact on him.
Right.
Because now there was nobody could tell him anything. Now. I mean, his mother, by the way, has a very, very strong force in his
sure. family.
But he also, you know, he doesn't necessarily going to listen to
right.
him.
Right.
Earl had that authority in which, you know, yes, he was an incredible BSer and he told all kinds of stories that were not true.
Right.
But he was incredibly interesting guy, and I you know, I didn't have a lot of time, but I always enjoyed my interactions with him. And yeah, I knew he was BSing most of the time, but he was engaging and interesting and funny. But he did, if you pick out, he had some genius about him. Mm-hmm. He really understood, like, just one small thing. I always say this to people. It's like, you know, Michelle Wee's parents let her compete against Ernie Els when she was about 13 14, right? Tiger Woods, Earl Woods wouldn't let him even play against a 16-year-old. He would just wanted him to play against people, kids his age, and beat their brains
to get the taste.
Him to learn
how to win.
How to win.
Right.
How to win.
When you got your game, when you don't have your game, when you're hitting it good,
Yeah, he taught him.
Figure out a way.
He taught him how to win in those places, but he didn't taught him how to live life. All right, let's talk about the Ryder Cup this weekend. And the idea that the Americans are consistently have the best players, a group of individuals, and the Europeans are always a better team, where it's like the team itself, this is, to me, the greatest of golf sports, because golf is so individual, and yet this is such a team. I don't know. I love seeing the team aspect of golf, and I don't know if, like, in the golf community, there is that it is that special too, and you would know better than us.
Well, I mean, the easy and maybe like kind of lazy way to say it is that if the Ryder Cup was worth $10 million, the U.S. would never lose. because these guys are geared to for success, and most of it is
money driven. Yeah, success. Monetarily driven.
And the European guys, you know, their tour, the European tour, this is their cash cow, the Ryder Cup, right? Whereas here it's the PGA of America, not the U.S. PGA Tour. But the PGA of America that benefits, you know, that gets the $50 million.
Right.
And way back when, in the late 90s, David Duval and Mark O'Meara led a little bit of a mutiny saying, you know, we're doing this for free.
Right.
And there's $50 million on the table. We don't get any.
Right.
And so it became a thing for a while. And now the players get, you know, essentially a stipend of, I don't know what the number is now, but it used to be like $200,000, but you give it to a charity of your choice,
right?
Which for one of those guys was his kid's private school.
But for the Europeans, they're playing for their livelihood.
The Europeans are playing for their tour, and also they've mastered a lot of little tricks, which I think have been very clever. Just Wednesday, they came out wearing cheese heads. All the European players and the caddies. And this is something they've done before. I remember in 04 in Oakland Hills when Hal Sutton, you know, might go down as the worst captain in American history.
Probably.
It's close, but putting Phil and Tiger together when they just
hated each other, yeah.
And really, and it was really more Tiger hated.
Right.
But that said, Hal Sutton puts them together. He also created this uptight sort of a team room where, you know, it's like, let's get ready. It's D-Day. Well, they didn't interact much with the fans.
No.
So what did the Europeans do? The Europeans went to the gallery ropes.
Yep.
Took selfies. Yep. You know, were chatting, signing things during practice. They were loose.
Yeah.
And they've mastered the art of staying loose, yep. Number one. And B, they've mastered the art that they've had the cup 12 of the last 17
it's
times.
It's insane.
And every single time they say, well, we're the underdogs.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
After a while, I keep saying, wait a minute, how can you be the underdogs when you're constantly winning this thing?
Right. It's Tom Brady. Yeah. Tom Brady on the Patriots saying, like, no one's giving us any credit. Yeah, everyone's giving you credit, buddy. Relax. Yeah.
But this year, it's the U.S. with top-ranked players but a younger team. And it feels like the Europeans have a lot more experience. I mean, you've got Lee Westwood and Sergio Garcia. Like, those dudes are, yeah. I mean, they've been around forever.
Great experience in there. But maybe the Americans are too young and dumb to know what this, you know, not dumb, but you know what I mean? Too young and inexperienced as far as this goes to understand that you've been beaten 12 out of the last 17 to sort of just come in.
I like what Strick has done, Strick is in many ways an excellent captain for a U.S. Ryder Cup team because he's not a rah-rah guy. He doesn't come in and tell you, you know, give you some great speech. He's got a quiet authority about
him.
And when you talk to him, he's always quick with a smile. He's one of my favorite people out there.
He was a grinder too, like a winner, but a grind. And wasn't this guy who's a champion who had everything given to him and lived the high life and this and that? He seems like very workmanlike, earned his tour wins when he got them.
I mean, the fact that he lives still in Wisconsin, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
There isn't, you know, I mean, think about that. The guy spends the winters in Wisconsin. And this is my favorite Stricker story. I went one year to the BMW when it was in Chicago, and there is just in a playoff event, and there's the entire player parking lot is filled with brand new BMWs, and there's a pickup truck in there, right? And I was thinking, who's this guy with a pickup truck? And it was Stricker. He drove from like Wisconsin, drove down, and in his pickup truck. And it was not even a new one. It was kind of a big
right. And you throw the clubs in the back. It's like they're not even covered. They're not even covered.
It's incredible. But he's that guy, and I think he's picked a really, really. I like what he's done with the team because he's giving these young guys a shot, and I think that they don't have the scar tissue in a lot of ways. But you know, people like Xander Schauffele.
Yep.
I mean, these are talented people.
Sure.
Can't lie. These are the best in the world. And then he's mixing it in. He's got a really nice dynamic. I mean, Spieth and Justin Thomas have been friends since they were 10 years
old. Phenomenal.
So he's got a really, and what he's done, he's doing the pod system that Azinger had. So he's keeping three pods of four. But if you look, he's put the troubled children
away from each other.
One of them in each.
That's pod, right.
Right. So he's got DeChambeau. Don't put him in
with Brooks.
With Brooksy.
No, that's what.
And then, you know, DJ and Brooksy are not exactly the best of buds.
No. Anymore.
So DJ's in the California chilling group with the California guys. Mm-hmm. And who's their little pod leader? Freddie Couples.
Right.
So it's the perfect laid back. That pod works because Morikawa, great kid. Schauffele, great kid.
Yep.
Cantlay, good team guy, quiet guy, but quite very intelligent.
Yes.
And then DJ, who's as laid back as they get, you know, he's not going to think too much.
Yeah. And DJ, it's so funny because, it's funny. Someone said that Gretzky told him, you know, obviously told him, look, don't give the media anything. to DJ. Like, you don't have to like give, just play like you're, give the blank expression. And to me, I think he's smarter than he comes off, or he portrays himself to be, DJ. That's, to the general public, people feel like this guy, he's got nothing to say. There's, it's completely blank stare. I think there is, there's a method to that. Am I wrong?
I'll take the under.
He'll take the under. Oh, wow. All right, good.
There you go.
So,
he, look, you know, the thing about that guy is that I feel that if you ask him a question, he actually mostly will answer it, and pretty honestly. But as you know, he doesn't, he's not going to extrapolate.
He's not a deep.
But I don't think he's not going to extrapolate much in life either.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you could ask him about, I remember, you know, at some playoff event, and he had shot like 63 or something, and he was in the media room and we were waiting to start, and he's like looking on his phone, and and then he, and we're about to start, and he goes, anybody have the South Carolina football school? And I mean, it was
like,
the guy is just not, he's not that, look, I think he obviously wants to be the best golfer he can be,
sure,
but he's got a, I think he at least is aware that he has a tremendous natural talent. And, you know, I would say that he's probably, he's certainly, when he was with Butch Harmon, he worked harder than he had.
Yeah.
And he, because he didn't work harder prior to that. Butch at least got him to understand, you know, if you hit a fade off the tee, you hit it so long, you don't need to be hitting anything else. And then it's all about, where is your, where are you hitting from? You're hitting from 120 yards into most par fours.
Yeah.
So let's get your wedge game good.
So that, yeah,
and
that's
where really started to evolve from just the strength, because he's a physical specimen.
Right. You know? Can dunk a basketball. Most golfers cannot dunk a basketball. Yeah.
He, you know, him, Finau's another
one.
Physical specimen. And Finau's another good, again, I like Finau in the, in that team, because there isn't, you know, when you have, when you have like Bubba Watson, kind of, you know, he had his own, he brought his own, Patrick Reed. I mean, you got a lot of prickly people.
Yes.
And then now you're bringing in, you know, guys like Tony Finau, who everybody loves.
Right.
He's a good guy, you know, and tremendous talent. And, you know, I think that that's why I actually think the U.S. is going to win this.
There you go.
I don't think it's going to be close.
That was my next question. You don't think it's going to be close? Wow. Okay.
I think the U.S. is going to win this one pretty well. And look, you can also just look at it and say they're due, right?
Yeah.
They're
it's about time.
It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's about time. And they've got people right now. I mean, obviously Rahm is playing out of his
mind. He's unbelievable. Right?
Rory's, this is a big week for Rory. But if you go, you know,
down the line. 12, yeah.
This is the problem. You know, I always say this about the President's Cup. It's not that the top six on the international team couldn't beat the top six on the
They
US
can
team.
On any given day.
But the problem is the 7 through 12,
that's right.
The U.S. were always better. And that's where you win these competitions.
That's amazing.
You win them 7 through 12.
So it's almost like baseball. You got to have the bottom of your lineup be able to hit. If your bottom of your lineup can't hit, it doesn't matter what your first four do, because, you know, they can pitch around them or figure out some way for the matchup. All right, Jason.
Yeah, and there's a bit of money ball to it, too.
Oh, you know, of course.
Throwing in – you know, there's different, what the Europeans are really good at is taking one match and then turning that into something big that they can rally around. So, and 2004 was a perfect example. Hal Sutton sends out Tiger and Phil, right? And at the time I thought to myself, if they win, what's the big
deal? Yeah, there's no win. There's no win. Right? They're supposed to, yeah.
But if they lose, this is
catastrophic.
This is like losing the biggest battle of the world.
Yep.
Right. So it, and that's what happened. And then they lose twice.
Yeah.
He sends them back out again and they lose again. And suddenly the Europeans, I mean, you know, Monty was already the cock of the walk before this. And now suddenly that chest was puffed out.
I mean, and those are some, and those are some serious man boobs on Monty. Let's just say it.
There is definitely a
double D,
double D.
It is, but,
double D.
Those might be double
D's. All right. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Robert Lucidich is with us. His fantastic book, Unplayable, about Tiger Woods, 2009. I highly recommend anybody pick it up. You can get it wherever you get books. Am I right? Amazon, wherever you go.
I think Amazon is probably the way to
go. The way to do it. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, three stories happen in the world of sports. We'll break them down with Robert and show his ability to cover things, not just about golf. We've got the details. He'll break it down with us. This is View from the Cheap Seats. Don't go anywhere.
Hey guys, welcome back to the show. We have Robert Lucidich with us. We're going to get into Quick Hits in a minute. But first, I want to remind you guys, we are going to be doing some shows on the road. We are going to be in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're excited for that Northwestern football weekend. That's October 22nd, 23rd. And then we're going to be in Seattle doing shows at the Croc, which is an amazing rock club where I believe Nirvana played. Yep. Is that right?
It's not that specific one. They moved, but yeah, same club. Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's just say they did. November 18th through the 20th, that weekend before Thanksgiving. And then Phoenix, I believe it's the 8th through the 10th, right? Or the 10th through
Tempe
the,
Improv,
10th through yeah. the Improv. Tempe Improv. All on our website, superscholars.com. And we also have a Patreon where we're doing new episodes of Cheap Seats. But let's get into this right now. Oh, Robert, is there anything else that people can, where they can catch you, follow you on Twitter?
I love to waste time on Twitter.
Great.
So why not put at Robert Lucidich on Twitter, tweet me something. I usually get back to people.
Lucitich. Yeah, so check that out. All right, let's get to some quick hits. Mike Piazza, Mike Piazza is not a loved human being. Okay, he's in the Hall of Fame. A lot of people question whether or not he used steroids. There's that swirling out in the world. There was a Belle and Sebastian song about him that questioned his own sexuality, which has never been resolved at any point. I guess I would love some resolution on that one way or the other. I'm saying just be who you are, Mike Piazza. And then recently he posted video. He would not go back to Dodger Stadium he didn't go back for the night that they honored Tommy Lasorda with a bobblehead. Tommy Lasorda, the great Dodger manager, just passed away. Yeah. But he did make a video supporting crazy conservative right-wing talk show host Larry Elder, which to me, I'm like, why is he dipping a toe in that? And he did it from Italy, no less. Does it not surprise you? It's almost like he got away with murder in some way. He's in the Hall of Fame. Don't you want to say, Mike Piazza, don't go dip?
Just shut up for the rest of your life. Just seriously shut up.
Well, I mean, look, unfortunately, I wanted to make a little comment before we get into what I'm about to say. I was spilled the handlebar mustache thing.
He went way down. Yeah, that was crazy. Yeah,
it was a little village.
Yeah. so maybe that's more telling. Fair.
Maybe there was a biker jacket and a hat, black hat that went with it.
Bell and Sebastian. Yes.
But I think that we, unfortunately, and I've been drawn into this. I mean, I would say that before 2016, mm-hmm. I'm not saying I wasn't political because I was political in mind, but I didn't really discuss politics with a lot of people. And now I feel that the first thing that we're doing is we're critiquing someone else's political views. And again, I tend to blame Trump for everything. Mm-hmm. I'm one of these people that just looks at it and says, well, Trump did this. In truth, he exploited what was already there. And he did it in a very diabolical, despicable way, the way he does everything. Mm-hmm. But he exploited the visions that were already there that I personally, honestly, maybe because I live in California, I just didn't feel them. I didn't feel that there was this ripping apart of the country, but I also don't watch Fox News.
Right.
So I just was naively walking along thinking, things are pretty good. I didn't realize that, 25-30% of people in this country hated Barack Obama.
Hated.
And I never felt we... that. And I feel like a lot of it was because of the color of his skin. Mm-hmm. And so we start going down these lines now, down these roads where there is no more unity.
Right.
It's just division.
Right.
It's division. You're on the red team. You're on the blue team. There is no red, white, and blue team anymore.
Right.
And I find it really sad. So, here we are talking about Mike Piazza's political views. I mean, it's insane. Like, why would anybody care? But we're in this world right now where, when a famous athlete or a celebrity just comes out and says something that you think to yourself, this is insane.
Yeah.
How could you be supporting these causes? And worst of all, be supporting a lie
right.
designed to essentially undermine, if not completely destroy, 240 years of American democracy.
I would say this, it's if insane. Mike Piazza came out and made a video saying, I support Liz Cheney and her sort of attempt, to be, if Mike Piazza had a ranch in Wyoming, totally possible. A lot of people from Los Angeles do. And he says, I support Liz Cheney in her fight to not be, you know, sort of run against and give her a chance. Right. I would not be saying anything right now. I'd be like, all right, okay, fine.
Or if he were to say, you know, let's bring back the Republican Party that I knew, that I grew up with, that doesn't feel as crazy, but that focuses on fiscal responsibility and X, Y, and Z. I don't think anyone would be saying anything. It's a non-story.
But when you throw your weight behind a crazy, you know, a crazy person, you got to be like, all right, that's a choice, Piazza, and people are going to come after you for it. And then they're going
to
start.
This is the moment where I was like, I used to be against Roger Clemens for throwing part of the bat that broke when Piazza, like
throwing it back at Piazza. So that actually makes,
now I'm like,
I understand, I'm on Clemens' side. So now I'm mad at Piazza for putting me on Roger Clemens' side. Thanks a lot for doing that, because no one should ever be on that side. All right.
I don't know about being on Roger.
I'm mad that it just, even for that one moment, I felt that. All right. So I'm legitimately mad that the Los Angeles Angels are not better than they are. You have the best player. You want to talk about sort of once in a generation, once in a century players. Shohei Ohtani could be that once in a century player. I really do think if he was on.
It makes you mad at Mike Trout.
Right. I'm mad at everybody in Los Angeles, because the Angels are the team you go to play on when basically it's like witness protection. Hey, I want to go get lost. I still want to make baseball money. It's like I'm playing for a professional team, but I want to get lost.
Yeah.
But the idea that you have this guy who is just such a singular talent, one that we haven't seen in years and years and years, and you can put him in a Tiger-like context, I think, eventually. But imagine if this guy was playing on a team like the Yankees or a team like the Rays.
Red Sox
or the Rays or someone where you're like
Cubs, even the Cubs,
where he would get that sort of media attention and get the same attention that you would start to, I think, either you'd see how strong he was mentally. Can he handle it? Yeah. And B, you might be talking about, again, ejecting him into the stratosphere. So I'm a little bit sad that they, you know, these are the stories that come out from the Angels, that they had Angels infielder Luis Rengifo was charged by Venezuelan authorities for forging divorce documents and selling property without his ex-wife's consent. So that's what we're talking about, the Angels.
Good story.
Right? It's a good story. I mean, he's got money. as a journalist, you're like, that's a good story. All right, that's a good story.
But like forging documents and selling property is kind of like the it's like the fraud double play.
Yeah, it is. He turned two, so to speak.
For sure. He turned two. He did. I mean, look, the Angels, the problem with the Angels is they've always existed in the shadow of the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And so they were the California Angels. Nobody rallied around them then. And then they became the Anaheim Angels. Yeah. Nobody. And then they became the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. Okay. And it's insane. I mean, So Orange County, you would think, would be able to support, I mean, certainly the Southern California market is bigger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Padres have their own. They have their own.
And they're good again, yeah.
And a good one. Uh-huh. And the Chargers left, so they've got it pretty much to themselves.
Right.
And the Angels are just kind of down the freeway between the Dodgers and the Padres.
Right.
And they've always been that way. I think that the market's there. I don't think that the ownership has properly engaged the fan base. So there is a fan base because, you know, nobody lives and dies by if the Angels win or
no.
I mean, you know, the first place I came to when I came to the United States was San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And I just became, you know, a fan of the sports teams there. And Montana was there. The 49ers were great. But as a left-handed batter and golfer, I looked at Will Clark as my favorite.
He's the guy. Oh, yeah.
He was the greatest. I mean, I love that swing. I loved his swing.
Amazing.
And so I became a Giants fan.
Right.
And, you know, for a good amount of time, pretty much until Barry Bonds got there, and then I had big problems being a Giants fan. But But for a good amount of time, I cared if the Giants won the night before. It would affect me. Right. Because especially if they're in a race with the Dodgers.
Yeah.
I don't know that the Angels are out of every race, 2 months into the season. So,
I mean,
the problem, I think, at the end of the day, I always say this, it's like, if you have the right owner, they hire the right people, why are the Detroit Lions terrible?
Yeah.
It's because
the ownership sucks. Ford
family has no concept. They could literally, you could put Bill Belichick in there and it's not going to work because clearly something else is happening there. They can never make the right decision. Get to a fork in the road. We're going to go this way.
It's so interesting. And in golf, the sport that you cover more closely, there are no owners. I mean, guys are their own owners of their own brand, I guess, so to speak. You are the CEO and president of your own thing. So it is interesting that you don't have that other layer that could screw you up. I mean, it takes all the excuses there are now away. It's just on you, which is a little bit scarier.
Look, and the PGA Tour is also very much geared to looking after its members.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Very, very protective of its members.
Very.
Only because gambling is going to make them so much money.
Yeah.
Are they now finally wrapping themselves around, gambling was illegal and on the PGA Tour until not long ago.
I know.
And Phil Mickelson was, betting for substantial amounts of money. But they looked the other way because they protect, but they also wanted to protect the squeaky clean brand.
Yes.
The PGA Tour. We raise money for charity. Yep. We're good guys. We're family men. Yep. So anything that disturbs that narrative kind of gets pushed and buried. So
that's a great point. All right. Finally, I have a problem with any sort of paperwork, like for anything. If my kids have to renew their passports right now, and like the idea or thought of having to fill out all the documents and then take it to the office and make the appointment and go that. So I had to go to
traffic school online to erase the points of a ticket, and I put it off for a month and I still hated every minute of it.
And you're done with it and you still hate it. So I get it.
I have anxiety.
I get it when people make mistakes signing.
Can you guys do a traffic school? I'll just go get a ticket just so you.
Oh, we'll host it. We'll host.
Yes.
Yeah. We'll make it funny. That'd be so much fun.
We'll make it funny.
Sure. I would do that. So I get it when people make mistakes signing up for things. The Bristol Half Marathon, which just happened, took place alongside the Bristol 10K in the Great Bristol Run on Sunday. Omar Ahmed had originally signed up to run the 10K, but ended up accidentally running and winning the half marathon in just 63 minutes. He went the wrong way when he reached the point of the course where it diverged into two different distances. There should be.
Is this a Robert Frost poem?
There should be so many signs of people being like, are you in the 10K? Go over here. Wait, are you in?
Oh, no, over there.
You're in the half marathon. So he runs the wrong way, wins the half marathon, and then they
dust the field.
They disqualify him because the next closest person was 4 minutes behind him, and they disqualify him. Now, this is not Rosie Ruiz running the first 10 minutes and taking the subway to the end, okay? This is a guy who actually did. I think in this...
No, this is like in golf where if you hit a great shot, but you write it down wrong on your scorecard, that it can cost you a penalty.
And DiVincenzo loses the Masters because... He didn't look at the scorecard and he just signed it. And, which by the way is maybe the dumbest rule in golf. I mean,
it's so dumb.
Does Tom Brady go, let me just check the score
here? No.
Okay, I'll sign. We scored 42. I'll sign. We all know what the friggin' score is.
Man. Right. And so to me, that was like the thing about it where I say, all right, this is where organizations and governing bodies need to be more nimble and say, all right, that was a mistake, but we can clean that up in some way. All right. We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we got a very special a conversation from the great beyond with Doug Buffone about the new quarterback change that kind of was forced and happened. Is he happy about it in the Chicago Bears land? We'll be right back. Thank you, Robert.
Hi. Hey guys, welcome back to the show. Huge thank you to Robert Lucidich. He's unbelievable. I just love talking golf with him, and his knowledge and very specific knowledge of Tiger Woods, and just how deeply
intimate knowledge of
like talking to Earl Woods. That is, he has a doorway into that that we just can't even understand. We'll have him back on in other major golfing events, but as mentioned before, we have to close things out today.
We're into the NFL season.
NFL season is happening, and the Bears, I know, wanted to bring Justin Fields along even after he had an unbelievable preseason where every fan is screaming, throw him in, put him in a game there. And instead, they played Andy Dalton until Andy Dalton got hurt. I want to know what's going on in just on the ground, or actually in the air,
hearts.
In the sky, in the hearts. And so we bring in from the great beyond, the greatest, one of the greatest Bears. Chicago Bears ever, Doug Buffone. Doug, welcome to the show.
We are live at 6-7 lead, 6-7 the score. I'm your host, Doug Buffone, for our annual Bears rack up. I'm joined today by two fellows who look like a mirror that came to life.
Yep.
They're hanging out with me here on the show. We're going to be taking all your calls. Don't forget, this show is brought to you by Polecats.
Polecats.
If it climbs up, it'll slide down. 2-for-1 drinks on Wednesday night. And wow. You can get free wings on Thursday if you're there before 3 p.m.
I don't want to eat there. But so let's talk about the Bears, and let's talk about them. How do you feel about Andy?
First of all, Andy Dalton and his injury.
He's a garbage can.
Andy Dalton's a garbage can?
He's a garbage. He's a red-headed garbage can.
No.
And they took him out there, and he couldn't even. You're right. You know why? Because the trash gets picked up.
Okay.
And they should have left this guy down on the ground. I don't want anybody to be hurt,
yeah.
But that is disgusting.
Yep.
They put that guy out there. I'm not saying he didn't have a good run when he was playing in Ohio, but let's be honest, they'll let anybody
Cincinnati,
play in Ohio.
They will in Cincinnati,
I'm talking about the university and the team.
Okay.
All right? That guy, they put him out there, and they prayed. Well, I actually had a conversation with St. Peter. I said, hurt that guy. Get Boone Strawberry Fields put him out there on the game. That guy's a garbage can too. He's a 14-year-old kid, and he's going to be better than what they had out there right now. Can that kid even play football?
Okay, so Justin
Fields. Speaking of playing in Ohio, I'll take an Ohio State, all right? Mm-hmm. Ohio State, okay?
So we're happy about Justin Fields. I mean, he's the future.
Am I happy?
Well, he's the future of your team.
You got the defense out there. They're out there running around like their own gang from that movie, The Warriors. Uh-huh. Okay,
sure.
they got beer bottles on their hands, hitting people in the face.
Okay,
and they're playing good, and it doesn't matter because you can't move the ball up the goddamn. I'll say it, yeah. Up the goddamn field.
Yes,
okay.
You got to be able to move the ball, and I think Justin Fields gives
Let's
you your best.
Let's go to Cindy.
Oh, no.
Let's go to Cindy and Palos Heights. Cindy, you're on the air.
We're not in a call-in show.
There's no one on the line.
But if you say that, you got to buy the ticket.
Okay, sure. So Justin Fields is, to me, gives you the best chance to win and the most exciting, the best ceiling.
Bryce, I see you out there on the 255. We'll go to your next.
Bryce.
What are you guys happy about?
I'm just saying, as outsiders looking into a Bears life.
Tell me about
life,
it. I'm more outside than everybody. I'm trying to get a taste of Chicago going on up in heaven, but you can't get the Gale Street Inn to bring their goddamn wings up here.
Okay.
And Ron Santo's got his new heaven legs, and he keeps showing them off to everybody.
He keeps doing that heel click.
God. It's like, dude, if I see your calves one more time, I'm going to punch you in the gut.
Okay, so things are going up.
Up on the outside, you were saying?
It's worse than the outside. We're saying there could be hope in the future for the Bears if Justin Fields comes along.
Let's go to Neil in Portage, Indiana. Neil, you're on.
No,
there is no Neil.
There is no Portage, Indiana.
And there is no Neil. All right, so.
Wait, you guys like it?
I think it's good for you. There's potential in it for the first time in a Bears.
Well, there's always potential before the goddamn game starts.
Okay.
And then they shoot the gun off, and everybody starts running around the field seeing who could be the first to the end zone, and then the first team to the end zone is whoever wins.
I think that, well, not the first team in the end zone, whoever ends up in the end zone last.
They play football different up here.
Okay,
I get it mixed up between how you guys still do it down there.
Okay, well, I'll say this. I think the NFL is better when the Bears are good, and I would like to see the Bears good. Even though Justin Fields went to Ohio State, and as a Michigan guy, it kills me, I would like to see the Bears play well.
And it doesn't matter, okay? Mm-hmm. Because they got Virginia McCaskey, who, by the way, she's been up here for 7 years.
She's
been
up
here.
She's still alive. She's been dead.
They've been weakened. I'm not saying she's dead. She's kind of like she has a timeshare.
She's in
every every time she goes to sleep, she shows up for a couple minutes and then she goes back down to you guys. But they got her. They don't give a shit about anything. They put a goddamn spaceship in the middle of Soldier's Field.
Okay.
And then they pipe in the Italian beef and the beer. They don't care if they win or lose. Say it's good for football. It's good if they'd actually win a goddamn game.
Now, I heard you say,
did they win last week?
They didn't. I heard you say Soldier's Field. Now, is it Soldier Field?
Look, technically it's Soldier Field, but if you care about Chicago in any way, you drop an S, okay?
Thank you.
Or you take an S off. Like, I'm going to go to Chicago Cub game later on today. Okay. I've been down to the Jules grocery store.
So you add an S.
I'm not a fan of the St. Louis Cardinal.
Okay, so it's how much money, leave a penny.
But with S's, goddamn it. All right, we got to wrap this up. Okay. We'll be right back with Brenda in Downers Grove. Brenda, I see you hanging out there. I want to get to you. Thanks so much for calling in on 670 at 670 The Score.
All right, there you go. That is the show, you guys. Thank you so much. Join our Patreon for new episodes of Cheap Seats. We've got a new one coming each month, plus extra footage from each of these interviews that we did. We have an extra great quick hit with Robert Lucidich, and then a little Patreon pod once a week. So join it. It's patreon.com/Sklar Brothers, and we'll see you next week. Punch a waterfall.
Star Bands Audio, a podcast network.